Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. A little over a week out from Election Day, and the midterms are indeed heating up. Several states are reporting huge numbers showing up at the polls for early voting, and those last-minute super PAC-funded ads are flooding the airwaves. Now, the midterms are typically seen as a referendum on the sitting president, and certainly that is true in this case. But as to the outcome, particularly in Congress, nothing's guaranteed. For all the talk of Democrats and their blue wave, Republicans are saying that that wave may crash into a red wall. So this hour on Point, we'll check in with analysts and reporters on the final stretch of the 2018 midterm elections. And you can join us. What is your top issue as you head to the polls next week? Or have you already voted in early voting? And what are you hearing from the candidates in your state? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start today in Washington with Janet Hook. She's national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Janet, welcome back to On Point.
Hello. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Also joining us from Washington is Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, which provides nonpartisan campaign analysis. He's also a political analyst for CNN and Roll Call. Nathan, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let me just get both from both of you your big picture take on where we are right now, because there has been a lot of enthusiasm on the ground from Democrats here. But do they have the momentum on their side, or have things been shifting in recent days here? And Nathan, let me just start with you. What do you see?
Well, you know, I've always kind of looked at these midterm elections as two Americas, because when we're talking about blue waves and tsunamis and any other weather metaphor that you might be hearing,
right,
it really doesn't apply to the Senate. I mean, the Senate map has always kind of been in favor of Republicans, meaning there are more Democratic senators up for re-election, more of them in red states. You know, in the bottom line, I think that Republicans are most likely to maintain control of the Senate and maybe even gain seats in the Senate. And I could see the president sort of grasping that as the red wave materialized, when really we've kind of been saying this for months. But the House is a completely different story. I mean, it's a different America, a different battlefield, where Democrats don't have to win in deep red Republican territory. And I think that's the House is where Democrats can make big gains. And I think at this point are still most likely to regain the majority.
Huh. Interesting. So, Janet, are you seeing something similar out there?
I am. And on the question of enthusiasm, I mean, really, I think everybody's totally revved up and ready to vote. In a lot of places, they already are voting. Big turnout in early voting in states that have it already. For a long time, the Democrats had a big enthusiasm advantage because voters and people who hadn't previously been involved in politics got very fired up by Trump's election. And so there's been, in our polling at the Journal and elsewhere, big enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans. But over the last month to 6 weeks, that's really that gap has diminished as Republicans have really gotten much more engaged, starting first in the aftermath of the big fight over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. But even as that kind of fades from prominence, there are other issues. And President Trump is going all around the country, state after state rally. And the whole point is to keep Republican enthusiasm high.
Right. And so, Nathan Gonzalez, what are we seeing in terms of if Janet's right? And I definitely think she is, that we had that surge of Republican interest following the confirmation hearings of Justice Kavanaugh. But if that motivation is starting to, you know, wane a little bit, what's taking its place? I mean, the GOP is running lots of ads on, you know, immigration and jobs, for example.
Yeah. You know, I think Republicans are struggling with what they are against this cycle. I mean, in the past two midterm elections, Republicans have been they were rallying behind being against President Obama and Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And that was two critical practical things that helped boost their enthusiasm, and they don't have that really anymore. I mean, they're maybe trying to use it a little bit, but they're going to Nancy Pelosi, or they're going to how Justice Kavanaugh was treated in the confirmation hearings, or they're talking about the caravan, or talking about how individual Democratic candidates are too liberal for these districts in these races. But I think Republicans are struggling. They just having something to rally against is more powerful than having something to rally for. And that's where Democrats have the advantage, because they have President Trump. I mean, he is unifying and energizing the Democratic Party better than any Democrat actually ever could. And so Republicans are still searching for that. I don't know that they found the one issue that's going to get, you know, the typical base out to vote.
Huh. Janet, would you agree with that?
I think we're beginning to see what the Republicans' closing argument might be in the new ad out from the Trump campaign, which is kind of a combination of what they're for and what they're against. I call it kind of morning in America with a dark cloud. Mm-hmm. It's a vision of voters talking about how good things are right now, but if Democrats take control, it'll all go away. So it's kind of upbeat and cheerful and ominous. And notably, President Trump himself doesn't appear in the ad, which is probably a good call.
Right. Well, so let's talk a little bit more specifically about the Senate here for a second, Janet, because as Nathan said earlier, he sees the possibility of the GOP picking up seats in the Senate, in fact. So I want to hear a little bit of tape of what's happening on the campaign trail in Florida, right, where there is the race between incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and Florida's current Republican Governor Rick Scott, who is running for Senate as well. So first of all, let's hear from Senator Bill Nelson sharply responding to Rick Scott's assertion that Bill Nelson supports higher taxes. And this happened at a debate earlier this month.
The governor keeps coming out with one whopper after another. Apparently, you never got your mouth washed out with soap after telling a lie.
So that's Senator Bill Nelson. They're really pushing back on Florida Governor Rick Scott. In an interview with Fox News on Wednesday, Rick Scott explained what he sees as the difference between him and Senator Nelson.
In my case, I'm a worker. In Senator Nelson's case, he doesn't do anything. He's never done anything. He's been around for 42 years. He's done nothing on education, nothing on the environment, nothing on transportation. He doesn't do anything.
Janet Hook, what is this Florida Senate race telling you?
Well, it is one of the biggest, most important Senate races, just because it's in a swing state.
Yeah.
Florida is very closely divided between Republicans and Democrats, unlike some of the other toss-up states like North Dakota and Montana. Those are big, wide Trump margins in 2016. In Florida, Trump only won by less than 2 percentage points. So it's a barn burner. And really, frankly, the biggest difference between Nelson and Scott is that one's a Democrat and the other is a Republican. So what it means is that they both have to rev up their bases, but they have to be kind of careful. So, for example, Rick Scott has not been all buddy-buddy with President Trump the way other Republican candidates have been, though he has said that he will go to the Trump rally that is going to be in Fort Myers next week. I think he can't close by keeping his distance from President Trump.
Mm.
And I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Janet. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because in some ways the most important factor in that race may actually be the gubernatorial race in Florida, because there's an even more heated, high-profile race going on at the top of the ticket between Andrew Gillum, the Tallahassee mayor who's running for the Democrats, and Ron DeSantis, the former House member. Gillum has been really revving up the Democratic base, young minority voters that might not otherwise turn out. And Ron DeSantis is a real Trump loyalist, and so his ability to turn out Trump voters is probably pretty powerful for Nelson, for Rick Scott.
Well, in fact, you're exactly right about the high tenor of the gubernatorial race in Florida. So I want to just play a little bit from a recent debate between Gillum and DeSantis here, because it was quite fiery. This was just last Wednesday in Fort Lauderdale, and Andrew Gillum, the Democratic candidate, current mayor of Tallahassee, really went after the support his Republican opponent, Representative Ron DeSantis, has garnered from white supremacists, Gillum said. And before we play this clip from Gillum, I just have to issue a warning that it does include reference to some derogatory language.
He's got neo-Nazis helping him out in the state. He has spoken at racist conferences. He's accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim, N-I-G-G-E-R. When asked to return that money, he said no. He's using that money to now fund negative ads. Now, I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
That's Andrew Gillum. Well, Ron DeSantis responded to Gillum's criticism concerning these speeches at conferences that DeSantis has given that were organized by conservative activist David Horowitz. And here is Ron DeSantis responding.
It was not a racial conference. That is an absolute lie. And I'm not going to sit here and take this nonsense from a guy like Andrew Gillum, who always plays the victim, who's going out and attacking, aligning himself with groups who attack our men and women in law enforcement, attack our military. He still will not disavow the Dream Defenders. None of these things people are saying did I endorse. He endorsed the Dream Defenders, and they endorsed him, and that is wrong.
That's Ron DeSantis at a debate against Andrew Gillum just on Wednesday. Let's go to a really quick call here. Eileen is calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Eileen, we've got about a minute before the break, but you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. And I have already voted. I have listened to all of the debates. I am a registered Democrat, but I don't always vote my party line. And watching the debates between Gillum and DeSantis was very eye-opening. The demeanor of Mr. DeSantis was almost too familiar to our president of the United States. And the thought of having Trump-like governor in our office running our state horrifies me and frightens me deeply. So I watched, as I said, I watched the debates. I've read everything I can, and I have voted very happily for Gillum. And I hope he will become our governor because we need some positive energy in our country, but I'm happy to start that within our state.
Well, Eileen, calling from St. Petersburg, Florida, thank you so very much for your call. We are talking about the midterm elections. We're a week and a day away from the big voting day, and I'm speaking with Janet Hook. She's national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nathan Gonzalez also joins us. He's editor and publisher of Inside Elections, which provides nonpartisan campaign analysis. What are you seeing from the candidates in your district? Do you like what you hear? And what do you hope for the outcomes for these midterm elections? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the midterm elections. We are a week and a day away from voting day, although in many states, there's been huge turnout for early voting. So what do you think that means? We want to hear from you. What are you seeing from campaigns and from candidates in your state, in your district, and what do you hope for the outcome in these midterm elections? I'm joined today by Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections. And Nathan, before the break, Janet was talking about how in Florida that gubernatorial race is garnering a lot of attention and potentially pulling a lot of people to the polls. And we heard a caller say exactly that. So I was wondering if Florida serves as an example. There are a couple of key states where gubernatorial races may be sort of more the political center of gravity, and who might that attract to the polls?
Yeah, I think it's specifically to Florida and specifically with Gillum. I mean, I think his ability, if he can turn out younger voters and African-American voters in a midterm, the way that in times when Democrats have struggled to turn out those voters in midterm elections, I think it could have an impact further down the ballot. You know, when we zooming out, when we have multiple House and Senate, you know, when we have multiple competitive races on the ballot, sometimes I'm not sure which race is driving what. But what I think is interesting about the House and the Senate maps, going back to that two Americas, is that there's actually not a ton of overlap between the competitive U.S. House races and in the Senate map. Now, Florida is one of the exceptions to uh-huh. that, where there are at least a handful of competitive House races. But elsewhere, you know, the pockets of the places where Democrats can make big House gains, such as New York and California. I mean, they have gubernatorial races, but they're not particularly competitive.
I see. Well, let's take a quick call here. Garrett's calling from Clarkston, Michigan. Garrett, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me on, Magna. And thank you, a panel, for taking time for me today. And I wanted to bring up something here quickly, because I do live in a state of Michigan, which obviously flipped red for Donald Trump in 2016. And, you know, I neighbor one of the counties that helped Donald Trump win the election. And I find one interesting thing here in this state, and then I have a question for you as well, too, Meghna. One thing I find interesting here in the state of Michigan is that there seems to be this consensus of what is Donald Trump's economic policy going to be moving forward. Obviously, this is a heavy manufacturing state. This is a state that's kind of gone through with a lot of the deregulation that Donald Trump had gone through mm-hmm. with the previous governor, Rick Snyder. But again, he wasn't the kind of fiery personality that a Donald Trump was, and he was more so just a progressive guy who was in office there. But I want to ask you guys this question, and in terms of, you know, what does potentially what looks like in the state of Michigan to be a blue wave coming in, what that impacts and what that leads on the state and local levels here, meaning for Donald Trump and the Republican Party in Michigan in 2020. You know, this was one of the states, again, that flipped over. There's a proposal ballot here that will potentially, you know, change the districts, the voting districts, which could lend in favor of the Democrats, I guess, in the House, especially in the state of Michigan. And so I find it to be a very perplexing yeah. state, which, you know, not many people seem to, you know, talk about when it comes to a battleground state.
Yeah. Garrett, actually, thank you so much for your call. Janet Hook, what do you think? I mean, if indeed there is sort of a good Democratic showing in 2018 in Michigan, could that have an impact on 2020?
Oh, for sure. And actually, there, if there's one state of consequence that seems poised to have a blue wave, it's probably Michigan, if only because the governor's race there is so clearly going in the Democrats' favor. Gretchen Whitmer seems to have a pretty sizable, substantial lead in the polls. And there are sort of miscellaneous House races down ballot. The incumbent senator there, Debbie Stabenow, is pretty safe for reelection. And in Michigan, as in the other Midwestern states that gave Trump his margin, it was by such a narrow margin
right.
that it doesn't take much to tip it against President Trump in 2020.
Yeah. And as Garrett was asking, it seems a question that he's hearing a lot in Michigan is what are going to be the next steps for the president's economic policy in the next 2 years, and how that might that have an impact on Michigan and Michigan workers?
Well, it depends a lot on what happens with the tariffs that he's
yeah.
proposed and imposed. Because it's just the economic impact of that is sort of uncertain, and he alternates between talking about imposing more tariffs on the one hand, or using them as a bargaining chip. It probably helps stabilize the industries in Michigan that they've come to a new NAFTA style agreement. But if there's one thing about Donald Trump and his policy, that's safe to say it's I kind of don't know what's next.
Mm. or I'm not sure how many policies the president holds near and dear to his heart. I mean, I think if it's not working, and, you know, there's 2 years before the next presidential election, if something's not working, he could just turn do a 180 and say, all right, we're gonna do something else. And when it comes to Michigan or just the presidential race, the 2020 race in general, I think a lot depends on who is the Democratic nominee and what is the contrast between approaches and styles and their view on the economy, as well as how if people feel like the country's headed in the right direction when we get that far.
Right. You know, and I definitely understand how 2018 and the midterms are connected to 2020. But my goodness, we need to get through next week, first of all, right?
agreed.
So let's go to Georgia, because there's a bunch of really interesting races happening down there. And joining us now from Atlanta is Stephen Fowler. He's political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. We have a link to Stephen's reporting at onpointradio.org. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Okay, so I think the big headline-grabbing race in Georgia right now is that gubernatorial race between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp, the current Secretary of State for Georgia. What's the latest polling show? How close is this race?
Well, it's a very close race. There's also a Libertarian candidate, which matters because if either candidate doesn't get 50% plus one vote, we could be going to a December 4th runoff. And polls really have the two neck and neck and have for quite a while now. And so really, every vote counts and every person counts. And by this point, there aren't many voters that are undecided. It's just whether they're going to decide to vote early or vote on Election Day.
Okay, so this is then one of the reasons why the news over the past several weeks around voting rolls and the purging of voters from the rolls has become such a big deal in Georgia, because, of course, as I just mentioned, Brian Kemp is the current Secretary of State for Georgia. So I just want to hear a couple of pieces of sound from last Tuesday's gubernatorial debate in Atlanta. First of all, we're going to hear from Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams, really refuting Brian Kemp's statement that he has not suppressed voters as Secretary of State, even though there have been reports that maybe some 100,000 Georgians have been purged from the rolls.
This is a man who had someone arrested for helping her blind father cast a ballot. He raided the offices of organizations to stop them from registering voters. That type of voter suppression feeds the narrative, because voter suppression isn't only about blocking the vote. It's also about creating an atmosphere of fear, making people worry that their votes won't count.
Well, at that gubernatorial debate, Republican candidate Secretary of State Brian Kemp said that he has, quote, absolutely not suppressed minority voters.
Voters should look at the numbers and know that this is all a distraction to take away from Ms. Abrams' extreme agenda that she has for a government takeover of health care, wanting to give the Hope Scholarship to those that are here illegally, and many, many other radical positions.
That's current Secretary of State for Georgia Brian Kemp. Stephen Fowler, take a minute here to walk us through this controversy in Georgia. What exactly has happened with voter rolls in Georgia, and how important of an issue has this become in the last week of campaigning before the election?
Well, so the two candidates we have here really are the diametrically opposed ends of voting rights and voting access. Secretary of State Kemp has done a lot to clean up the rolls. Some people say purge the rolls of removing people of voting. There's also a record number of Georgians registered. As of yesterday, it was 6.9 million people. And early voting numbers are higher than they've ever been. For the 2014 midterms, we're at 1.1 million people that have cast a ballot early, as opposed to about 400,000 in 2014. But on the other hand, Stacey Abrams has dedicated a lot of her political career to getting more people to vote, getting minorities to vote, getting younger people to vote who haven't done. And so the two have clashed over the years, and it's culminated in this gubernatorial race. And now there have been recent reports about different numbers of people being on hold from their registrations or removed from the rolls for not voting for a few years. And a lot of it comes from Georgia's rather strict laws. They have strict photo ID. They have strict exact match registration, where if it doesn't match a state or federal database, then it's put on hold. And then there's a use it or lose it law, where if you don't vote for a few elections and don't respond to flyers or mailers from the Secretary of State's office, you can be removed from the rolls. So that kind of sets the stage for what this election is a proxy for, of voting rights and kind of the future of voting rights. Kemp says he's following the law, and Abrams says the law is suppressing people from voting.
Well, and Kemp says he's following the law, but I thought I was reading in some of the reporting around this that he may have been more enthusiastic than previous secretaries of state in examining the voter rolls to see who's in compliance with Georgia law.
Well, you know, that certainly is the case. One of Secretary Kemp's big platforms has been making it easier to vote. One of the things he says, it's easy to vote and hard to cheat. And so using, you know, kind of trimming the fat of the voting rolls is essentially what he said he's done. But many people say that maybe they didn't know. Maybe the postcard that they got went in the trash because it doesn't look like a big official government document. And so, you know, he has the ability to say, I'm just following the law. This is what I'm doing. There are more people voting. But then also on the flip side, it gives Stacey Abrams the opportunity to say, look at what my opponent's doing. He doesn't want you to vote. Mm-hmm. This is why you need to get out and vote.
Well, let's go to Lee, who's calling from Atlanta. Lee, you're on the air. Hi, Lee. Hi, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I just want to say that I was planning to vote by paper ballot. My wife and I requested absentee ballots. We made that decision. Even though we live here in DeKalb County, we made that decision because I went to the federal district court hearing on the electronic voting machines that Judge Amy Totenberg conducted in September, the middle of September. And she ruled that paper balloting and that we wouldn't rule out electronic balloting in this election. And so because of our concern about our votes being tampered with electronically, we requested absentee ballots. When they hadn't arrived in nearly 2 weeks, we went ahead and decided we would vote electronically. We went to our polling station. We voted electronically early voting last week on Monday.
Yeah.
When we were there, we were told that our request for a paper ballot had not been received. And there was plenty of time. We're in the same county where we requested it for those to have been handled.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was my concern that, you know, number one, paper ballots would have been our choice. But number two, we didn't receive them in time to really feel comfortable voting.
Yeah.
With an absentee ballot.
And then
she ruled that there's a concrete risk. That was her quote.
Right. You know, Lee, I'm going to have to take it back from you because you've given us a lot to think about. But thank you so much for your call. Stephen Fowler, you heard Lee there saying that he wanted to vote absentee, but said that when he was told that his request wasn't even received. I mean, are you hearing concern from voters about how this election's actually being this election's actually being run this time around?
Yeah. So, Meghna, there's actually a lot of different concerns and confusions and questions about how Georgia's voting system works. And that comes from even people who are politically active. There's 159 counties in Georgia, and they all have their own county elections boards that are responsible for doing things like setting up the voting machines and approving people's registrations and things like that. And on top of that, just about every part of Georgia's voting system is being sued for different reasons. The court hearing that Lee mentioned I was at for trying to move Georgia away from outdated touchscreen voting machines to paper ballots. There's also been recent suits about absentee ballots being rejected for things like a signature not matching one on file or somebody putting 2018 instead of their birth year. And another lawsuit says that absentee ballots are being unfairly rejected from certain counties that have higher minority populations. And so then there's the voter registration exact match piece that's being sued as
right.
well. So there's a lot of lawsuits around Georgia's voting system, but there's a lot of questions around Georgia's voting system as well.
Yeah. Janet Hook, you've been patiently listening here, but so much going on in Georgia. When you look to that state in the midterms, what do you see?
Well, there too, the governor's race is really galvanizing a lot of activity up and down the ballot. There actually are a couple of really interesting House races going on there. One of them is in Georgia's 6th Congressional District in the suburbs of Atlanta. It's kind of, for activists, like revisiting the scene of the crime. It was the site of a special election more than a year ago that Democrats poured money and national attention on and that they lost. There's a rematch now against the Republican who – not a rematch, Ossoff. John Ossoff, the last year's candidate, isn't running. But
right.
it's heated up and gotten closer, so they're taking another shot at that one.
Yeah. Well, let me just turn back to Stephen on that, because I think that that 2017 special election gets the nod of being the most expensive, as Janet was saying, congressional race
right.
in U.S. history.
Right. Most expensive. And I swear half of the Amazon rainforest must have been cut down to do the mailers. I mean, there were mailers from every group every day for this race. And this year, it's a different activist. Lucy McBath is running against it. But it's another tight race, as well as the neighboring district in Georgia 7, where the Democrat that's running there, Carolyn Bordeaux, is running on a strictly health care platform against incumbent Rob Woodall, who seems to confidently think that he's going to win without having to even run a television ad. But there's been a lot of money poured into both of those races.
Right. Well, Stephen Fowler, political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Really great and interesting report there from Georgia. Nathan Gonzalez, we've got a minute to go before the break here. And Stephen was talking about how in Georgia 7th, the Democrat there is running a strictly health care race. Now, this is something that we've heard from a number of other congressional races around the country, that the Democrats perhaps, you know, not actively talking so much about Donald Trump, but about health care and how effective a message that might be for them.
Yeah, absolutely. If you take a drink every time you hear a Democrat talk about health care or pre-existing conditions, you'll be well hydrated or very drunk by the time we get to November 6th. I mean, Democrats are all in on health care. They believe that that's the issue that they can win on, particularly if Republicans want to talk about the economy. Democrats want to bring it side by side with healthcare and say, okay, you might have seen a little bit more money in your paycheck, but what do your premiums look like, or how do you feel about access for people with pre-existing conditions? And so it's all about healthcare. But that 7th district race, you know, members of Congress who aren't taking their races seriously in this environment, I think, do so at their own peril.
Well, we are talking about the midterm elections. We're now a week and a day away. What are you seeing in your congressional district? Who are you looking for? What are you looking for in terms of who's going to represent you in Congress? Do you see this race as a referendum on President Donald Trump? And if so, what would you like the outcome of the midterms to be? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the midterm elections that are now a week and a day away. I'm joined today by Nathan Gonzalez. He's editor and publisher of Inside Elections that provides nonpartisan campaign analysis. Janet Hook is also with us. She's national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And let's go straight to our callers. There's a lot of them. So Leo, calling from Akron, Ohio. Leo, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. We are healthcare voters, and among other big issues leading up to this election, and it is just so utterly ridiculous to hear these claims that these GOP lawmakers are protecting people with pre-existing conditions when their votes have said just the opposite. And I know that they're banking on people not paying attention to everything in the weeds leading up to the election, but I mean, you have to be off the grid to not know that these people are attacking people with pre-existing conditions.
Hmm. Well, Leo, thank you for your call. Janet Hook, your thoughts on what Leo said?
Well, if Nathan was right in talking about how central the healthcare issue is for the Democrats, and if ever you wondered whether or not it was an important and winning issue, there's nothing quite like the Republican response. I think they're really nervous about the power of that issue. For the past, I don't know, six elections, the repeal of Obamacare has been the central campaign promise for Republicans. They didn't come through with that, and now the healthcare system is kind of in a mess again. And to the extent that there's one issue that has really broad resonance for people, it's the protections for people with pre-existing conditions that Obamacare provided.
Yeah.
And so the Democrats realize that, and now the Republicans seem to be realizing it too.
Well, this is playing out in so many different races across the country. Let's go to Nevada here, where in a debate between the candidates for Senate in Nevada, we had Democratic Representative Jackie Rosen, who's running against incumbent Republican Senator Dean Heller there. And you're going to hear first, this is Representative Rosen asking Senator Heller to tell a Nevada family and their son, whose name was Dean, why Heller, quote, broke his promise to protect people like Dean who have pre-existing conditions.
You promised them that you would protect their health care and that you would protect their protections from pre-existing conditions. And then you went back to Washington and you broke your promise. You caved. So I want to tell you, look in the camera. They're watching tonight. And what they want me to ask you is this, is to look them in the eye and to tell them the truth, really tell them the truth about why you broke your promise and why you support slashing protections for pre-existing conditions, why you want to hurt their son, Dean.
Yeah.
That's Representative Jackie Rosen, who's running against Nevada incumbent Senator Republican Dean Heller. And here's how Heller responded to Rosen's assertions at that debate.
You can say it 10 times. You can say it 100 times. You can say it 1,000 times. It's just not true. I wrote the replacement bill for the Republican Party. I know exactly what's in that bill, and what's in that bill includes pre-existing conditions.
Please tell them
so
the
I
truth.
Told,
look them in the eye and tell them the truth,
can,
Senator.
Can we answer the question?
That's at a debate between Republican incumbent Dean Heller and Democratic Representative Jackie Rosen in Nevada. And joining us now from Las Vegas is Megan Messerly. She's political reporter for the Nevada Independent, and we have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how much is healthcare factoring into this race between Senator Heller and Representative Rosen?
Well, as you just heard during that clip, it's been a huge focal point of the race. Like you all were talking about earlier, this is something that Jackie Rosen, the Democratic, a first-term congresswoman, has been really making an issue of in the race. And what it really comes down to is the fact that there was this sort of now infamous press conference that happened last summer where Dean Heller stood alongside our Republican Governor Brian Sandoval, and they both expressed significant concerns about the first repeal and replace proposal that Senate Republicans had brought forward. But then he ended up actually voting in favor of advancing repeal and replace to debate, and voted in favor of one of the repeal bills. And so this has been a huge focal point of the campaign. She's run numerous ads against him, accusing him of flip-flopping on the Affordable Care Act. She has this sort of memorable ad attacking Heller as Senator Spineless, featuring one of those sort of inflatable tube men you might see outside an auto repair shop, accusing him of sort of blowing in the wind when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. So it's been a huge issue in the race.
And how effective has it been on the campaign trail so far? I mean, what are the polls in this late stage telling you?
Right. So this race is still really close. If you listen to folks talk about it, maybe Jackie Rosen should have been a little bit ahead, given that Dean Heller was considered going into this cycle, the most vulnerable Republican incumbent senator facing re-election, facing re-election in a state that Hillary Clinton won in 2016. And so, he was sort of, didn't have the edge going into the race, but they're still neck and neck. If you look at the polls, he's been a little bit ahead in some of the polls, but most of them within the margin of error. So, you know, everyone is expecting this to be, you know, an extremely close race and come down to the wire. So I think, you know, the big question and what remains to be seen is how this message, you know, resonates with Nevada's, you know, nonpartisan, our independent voters here, you know, whether they do have those significant concerns about healthcare. And from what we've seen, healthcare really is a top issue for voters here in Nevada this cycle.
Well, Nathan Gonzalez, a little earlier in the hour, you were talking about how there are certain, there's a possible outcome where Republicans gain seats in the Senate. But this is one of those places where they are looking somewhat vulnerable. So what are you seeing in Nevada?
Well, I think one of the reasons why I think Republicans have a chance to gain seats is I'm not convinced that Dean Heller is going to lose. I think for much of the cycle, I really, you know, we had it as a toss. I think we've had it as a toss up for the whole race. We'll probably keep it there. But in the back of my mind, like, you know, I think he's going to lose. And so that matters to the math. But if he hangs on, or maybe Republicans hang on to Jeff Flake's open seat in Arizona, then, you know, that increases their ability to actually gain seats. But Nevada has been interesting. And I'll plug the Nevada Independent for Megan and her boss, John and Michelle and the whole team, because they know Nevada better than anyone. What struck me is how Nevada has been more of a slog for Democrats than what I expected. You just think, well, it's a Hillary Clinton state, but Republicans have a chance to hold the governorship. Dean Heller has a chance to be reelected. There's two competitive congressional districts that Democrats are defending, Jackie Rosen's 3rd district and the 4th district, which is open as well. And I think Democrats have had to spend, you know, more time and energy than they would have wanted to hold those seats. So it's kind of, I think this is midterm Nevada, not presidential Nevada, and midterm Nevada tends to be more Republican.
Megan, what do you think about that?
I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the interesting things we've been sort of keeping an eye on so far is, you know, turnout is much better for Democrats with early voting, which started a little over a week ago here in Nevada. It's been better than it was in 2014, in which we saw a complete red wave in Nevada. Republicans swept, you know, control of all of the state's constitutional offices, of the legislature, the competitive House seats. It truly was, you know, a red wave, which stands in such stark contrast to what happens in 2016. But that point is exactly right. You know, Democrats traditionally don't perform as well during midterm elections. So it's really going to come down to, you know, all that effort they are putting in with their ground game to try and get folks to turn out with the help of the powerful culinary union here, which is part of what's known as the Reed machine, started by, you know, obviously former Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, you know, under his tenure. So the big question is, can Democrats, you know, make this look a little bit more like a presidential year as opposed to a midterm year in which they traditionally don't fare as well?
Yeah, it's such an interesting thought that a midterm Nevada or midterm any state might be different than that state in a presidential year. But one more question for you, Megan. I mean, here we are just a week to go before the midterms. And I heard you say that, you know, obviously there's a lot of question around whether what direction certain voters might go, independent voters in Nevada, et cetera. But how much is the uncertainty right now? Is it that, like, are people still out there making up their minds based on certain issues or maybe last minute campaign stops? Or is it simply a get out the vote question now? Because I'm just like, who out there still doesn't know how they're going to vote in Nevada?
Sure. No, that's a valid point. I obviously, you know, a large part of it is the get out the vote, especially when you see, you know, Republicans really ramping up the base. You know, Donald Trump has been in town a couple of times over the last couple of weeks. You know, he's sending his sons in town. We had Senator Lindsey Graham in town. Vice President was in town over the weekend. So they're certainly ramping up the base, and so are Democrats. But there still is a relatively large nonpartisan voting bloc in Nevada. It's a significant percentage of registered voters. So the question, I think, for a lot of people is, you know, who really are those nonpartisans? Are they, you know, secret Democrats or secret Republicans? Or are there folks in Nevada that really do swing one way or another? And we are a very libertarian state. You know, we like to sort of make our own decisions. So I think there are some voters who are out there, you know, genuinely, you know, looking at the issues. A couple months ago, I was out in rural Nevada and met this elderly veteran who told me, you know, he was probably going to end up splitting his ticket. He was still debating in the U.S. Senate race and not sure what to go. So we do truly have some of those really independent voters here who probably are still making up their minds.
Well, Megan Messerly, political reporter for the Nevada Independent, speaking to us today via Skype from Las Vegas. Thank you so much, Megan.
thanks for having me.
All right, let's go to West Virginia now, where David is calling from Hedgesville, West Virginia. You're on the air, David.
Yes. How are you today? I have a position for the Republicans to run on. When you mentioned they had nothing to be for, I would like them to be for restoring American sovereignty. Let me explain. Back in 1943, we sent 600 men to their death, driving the Japanese out of Attu, Alaska. That's the last time we've been occupied, but now we don't seem to care that there are 11, or lately reported by Yale, 16 to 27 million people in the country undocumented, and a sovereign country needs to be able to control who is in the country. So I think that would be a winning issue for the Republicans.
David, if I may, I think I'm hearing Republicans speak a lot about immigration and especially their concern about undocumented immigrants. Are you not hearing that from candidates that you're interested in?
Yes, but they've not done anything. You know, they've controlled Congress. You could make a very good immigration law that would not be a magnet for people to come in, although we have some responsibility for the people that we've allowed to be in here, so we could have some kind of guest worker program for them for a while. But we could make a good immigration law that would protect our sovereignty, and we just don't have one.
David, thank you so much for your call. Janet Hook, let me turn back to you on that. So I found David's perspective here to be very interesting because he's seeing a failure of affirmative policy as the reason why he's not hearing enough from Republicans on immigration as something to stand for. What's your thought about that?
Right. I mean, he points to a really big problem in immigration policy is that it really is hard to change. The Republicans have controlled Congress and have a president very focused on immigration, and they haven't been able to pass any legislation of major consequence. Most of the changes in immigration policy have been done through executive order or administrative action. I mean, immigration is a very difficult issue, and there have been many attempts over the last couple decades to pass comprehensive immigration legislation, and there's general agreement it would have to be bipartisan, and it really has gotten to be the most partisan of issues.
Yeah. Nathan Gonzalez, you know, we were talking a little earlier about how Democrats are running on health care. Do you hear a lot of Republicans running on immigration, whether or not, to Janet's point, as she's saying, immigration reform is hard and thus far pretty much impossible to pass in Washington, but it is still, nevertheless, their views on immigration are a central part of the campaigns around the country, aren't they?
Yeah, Republicans are much more comfortable talking about immigration, national security, the borders. I mean, you know, bringing up the caravan in Central America, I think they would much rather talk about that than health care. Where we are seeing health care from Republicans, I think it's usually in a defensive posture, not offensive. But yeah, it's a if that's enough to rally Republicans and get Republican turnout up to a normal midterm level, I think Democrats will have a good night, but not a great night. But if Republican turnout is depressed, that's when we start looking at some really big numbers in the House.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple of minutes that we have, Janet and Nathan, let me ask you, how confident can we be? Perhaps the answer is not at all, given the uncertainty that we've all been discussing this hour. But I feel like we're still learning our lessons from the limits of polling from 2016 and the fact that perhaps maybe a lot of people don't want to tell pollsters how they're going to vote, or as we've seen in some primaries this midterm season, that perhaps we're going to get a lot of people coming to the polls for the first time who aren't regular or expected voters. I mean, how much could that those questions really have an impact on the final outcomes of these races, Janet?
There is so much uncertainty in who's going to vote where and when. And 2016 was a very humbling experience for people who thought they knew what was going to happen. And a very surprising outcome came about. And in this cycle, we've also had some surprising primary outcomes. I do think that when it comes to looking at polling, a lot of the polling that we see is national polling, including the very fine Wall Street Journal, NBC News poll that I have a hand in writing up. When you look at national numbers, we often focus on what we call the generic ballot number, which is, you know, the answer to the question, who do you favor to control Congress, Democrats or Republican? And that's an interesting number, engaging the national mood. But for looking at what might happen in toss-up races, you need to look at those numbers through a finer screen. And what we found in our last poll is that Democrats had a big advantage nationally and almost no advantage in toss-up races.
Nathan Gonzalez, we've got about 30 seconds here. What do you think?
Yeah, for a five-hour answer. No, this is the part of the cycle where I start to freak out and say, what if it's all wrong? But I look back at 2016, and our House and Senate projections were pretty darn close. And that was because we were looking at it state by state, district by district, not looking at it nationally. And so I think, you know, we can tell you, I think we've told you what's most likely to happen, keeping in mind that there could be errors in the data or the unlikely outcome can still happen.
Yeah. Well, Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, which provides nonpartisan campaign analysis. Thank you so much for joining us today, Nathan.
Thank you.
And Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Always great to have you, Janet. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.